Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today we're welcoming back Dr. Dhruv Kolar, who's a physician and assistant professor of health policy and economics at Cornell Medical School. And he is also a writer at The New Yorker, where he writes about medicine, healthcare, and politics. He was on a few weeks ago, and Dhruv, we had to have you back because, you know, some stuff happened in my life that I figured I would ask you about, but also there's so much more to talk about on healthcare. So excited to have you back on.
Yeah, happy to be back.
So, okay, 2 weeks ago, maybe 10 days ago now, I don't even know, my dad went in for a heart scan from this company called Sorin Medical, which I hadn't heard of before. It was a commercial heart scan, like non-invasive heart scan. And they wound up finding a long blockage of the proximal LAD artery. I guess this is what this is the blockage commonly associated with what they call the Widowmaker event. And then they also found a 95% blockage in his right coronary and two branches of his left circumflex artery. So he was immediately sent in for quadruple bypass surgery.
Wow.
And he had that procedure at Sinai and is in recovery now. It all has been playing out over the course of the past 10 days. But it made me think about the conversation that you and I had, which was really about the full body MRI scans. But these sort of commercial scans in general was kind of the topic. And it just made me think, well, okay, not all scans are made equal. And the heart scan is something that you and I didn't talk about. But this seems to be a whole area now where people are getting 3D models of their scans without having to do anything invasive. And in this case, it seemed to really work out.
Yeah. First of all, I hope that your father's doing well. And I know that undergoing bypass surgery is a huge event in someone's life. And so hopefully he's recovering well, and I'm glad that it was picked up. You know, it's hard to talk about these types of preventive scans in general because each one has different strengths and drawbacks. Different people might benefit to different degrees from a scan, particularly if your father was having symptoms. That would be a reason to get things checked out and whether it's this scan or a different scan. And so I think what this points to is that there's a lot of nuance that's needed when we talk about preventive scanning. In some cases, it's obviously a good thing when we think about colonoscopies, when we think about mammograms, potentially for people who are having cardiac symptoms, getting stress tests, this type of thing. I don't think we're at a place where we can recommend in a broad way for the population any number of scans. That type of thing requires data and evidence, and we want to make sure that people are benefiting. And it seems like in your father's case, fortunately, things were caught early, and it seems like he did benefit from it. But again, I think it's a matter of matching the right type of scan to the right type of patient.
Right. Yeah. And I also think age matters, right? Like you and I were talking about the MRI scans that you and I had, and you and I are not at a high-risk category for a lot of these things, whereas my dad has a family history of coronary events, including, you know, multiple brothers who had multiple heart attacks and strokes, and he's in his 70s. And so in that case, like what gets him in front of a company like that would be different than somebody like you or I. Yeah, what's amazing is he didn't have symptoms when he came in, which I think is wild. I'm sure he'll be now on their website. They'll be using him for marketing materials if this all works out, which I expect
yeah.
It does.
Well, one thing, I mean, it seems like in your father's case, I hope it has worked out well. One thing that we should just point out is that a lot of people will have blockages in their arteries that do not require surgery or stents. And so there's a lot of kind of controversy in cardiology and in medicine more generally. You know, when should you really put a stent in? And many cardiologists would say, if someone's not having symptoms, but the scan shows that there's some level of blockage in the arteries, we should not be putting stents in because people don't end up doing better and they may have complications from that type of procedure. And so it is a tricky area, even when it comes to, hey, you see a blockage, why not open it up? Well, there are reasons that potentially you don't want to open it up.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. And I think that one of the things that this does is it makes everybody kind of an expert on their own health, right? It's like the opinion of the cardiologist matters less if you're getting this piece of data that says, you know, it's like when I got that full body MRI scan and I'm being told to go talk to a gastroenterologist and I have like this node or something on my pancreas and then he's telling me not to worry about it. I'm like, well, okay, do I trust this guy? Based on this 5-minute interaction where he seems a little distracted, it's like you start to like wonder, right? And everybody becomes like an Aaron Rodgers of their own health.
Yeah. Well, to the extent that it gets people excited about health, you know, one of the things that public health and medicine has been trying to do forever, is just get people more interested in their own health, taking control of their health, adopting healthy behaviors. You know, if this type of testing, if certain types of devices, whether it's a sleep tracker or a continuous glucose monitor, gets people really jazzed about staying healthy, then it's probably a good thing. You know, there are drawbacks in some ways. You know, some people who have sleep trackers end up getting so anxious about their sleep that it worsens their, you know, their sleep quality. And so that's also a potential. But to the extent that these things help people get excited about staying healthy and being healthy and adopting healthy behaviors, I'm all for it. I also had a follow-up, I don't know if I mentioned, a follow-up MRI after my own full-body MRI for my prostate. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like the nodule that they found is dangerous, but it's actually not clear what it is. I mean, there's still some kind of schmutz in there.
Yeah, and now you've got to think about it.
Yeah, now I'll think about it and probably get another scan at some point. And so this is kind of the type of train that you can get on if you engage in some of these activities.
Well, you mentioned CGM, and I imagine this will get more attention in journalism at some point. This past week, I think it was this week or the week before, Dexcom was approved for over-the-counter CGM use. And for our audience, CGM is continuous glucose monitoring, which tends to be something that was used by diabetics, but now has been used by optimizers. You know, companies like Levels Health and others have gotten in the game. And if you watch carefully, you see people with these little patches on their arms. Like I saw a European football coach, soccer coach, wearing one of them the other day when I was watching TV. What do you think this means for the sort of future of that technology now that people can get it without any kind of consultation with a doctor?
You know, I think we should think really hard about what the end goal of these types of devices is. Like, is the end goal to live a longer life? Is the end goal not to get diabetes? Is the end goal to just have more information about your health because you feel like that in and of itself is a good thing? And each of those goals will probably lead us to different answers when it comes to, you know, should the average person pick this thing up? It is true that continuous glucose monitors, which, as it suggests, monitor continuously the level of glucose in your blood, is important and has been shown effective for certain types of diabetic patients. And you could imagine if you're always, you know, injecting insulin before and after meals and trying to figure out exactly where your blood sugars are, it can go dangerously low, it can go dangerously high, really important potentially for people to have that information. For the average person, you know, I don't think it's as clear. So we have tests, for instance, like a hemoglobin A1C test that a lot of diabetic patients will get once every 3 months. You or I could, you know, should get that at some point as well. And that'll show you basically an average of your glucose, your blood glucose over the past 3 months. Many people would say that's fine. You know, it's not the case that we need to know minute to minute changes in our glucose. What you want to know is that over the course of months or years, are you in a safe range? And that's good enough. So that's, you know, that's one end of the spectrum. And that's kind of a conservative approach to using these technologies. Other people would say, look, I didn't actually know that when I have that sweet balsamic vinaigrette, my glucose spikes to the extent it does. Or this protein bar that I thought was awesome for me actually leads to a huge spike in my sugar levels. And it might inspire people to stay away from those types of things or just have things on their mind in a different way. You know, if that's the case, then maybe it's a good thing. I'm not convinced that, look, an average person who is you know, relatively young and healthy will benefit a tremendous amount from having a glucose monitor in the sense that they're going to live a few years longer or not get diabetes in a way that they otherwise would have gotten diabetes.
The people who advocate for these things, right, like at least on the physician level, what I've heard multiple physicians who have these longevity practices say is, what I have my patients do is I have them, especially if it's somebody I'm trying to like teach them to be aware of their nutrition, is to wear it for a month. And just know, like, what are the common things you eat and how does it affect your blood glucose throughout the day? And because that affects your energy levels and it's not just the spike, but it's also the trough after the spike. And I did this, what was it, like a year and a half ago. I invested a little bit of money in Levels, one of these companies that kind of creates like a software on top of the existing glucose monitoring technology. And I did like a month or two. And what I learned was I was eating this oatmeal every morning. That was the equivalent of like eating a pizza every morning. Like, it was so crazy, the spike. So it was like a minor adjustment, whatever. And I had learned like little things throughout the course of using it, like certain dried vegetables I was getting from the supermarket in this bag had way more sugar in it than must have possibly been on the label and all this kind of stuff. And that people's bodies react differently and all that. But total luxury item. Like, none of that stuff is life or death for me. And if you think about people who are really dealing with major health risks, like obesity, et cetera, there's probably a bunch of other interventions, like including what we talked about last time, Ozempic, that will make way bigger difference than this pretty invasive thing that you have to stick into your arm every so often and it stays there. And it affects everything from like if you're trying to play sports and stuff, like I surf and that's when I pulled it out of my arm. I was like, it just felt weird going into the ocean with this thing on my arm all the time.
You know, all these things have a risk benefit calculus. And part of it, the risk can be just inconvenience. Part of it can be, you know, generating some level of distress and anxiety. Part of it can be cost for certain people who are spending their money on 20-odd supplements and a number of technologies. But there are potential benefits. And each person, I think, you know, it's one thing for the medical profession or the healthcare industry to push a certain type of technology and kind of advocate for. And I don't think we're there with these types of things right now in terms of continuous glucose monitors for the general population. But for an individual who thinks that they want a little bit more information, they want to know whether that oatmeal that they're eating in the morning is actually you know, doing a number on their blood glucose. It's something that people should consider, and it's something that if it works for you, it works for you.
Well, okay, let's get down to some more macro issues. You recently wrote, I think it was like a commentary piece, I don't know exactly how to describe it, for the New England Journal of Medicine and an associated sort of audio commentary about the phenomena of hospitals purchasing physician practices. And this is something that's also personal. The same dad I talked about ran an urgent care center in Alabama that was purchased by HCA Health, who also owned the hospital across the street. Let's talk about this before we then, there's also an associated private equity issue going on right now. But what did you find?
I think one thing that maybe, you know, the average person doesn't recognize is that over the past one or two decades, there's been a tremendous push toward hospitals buying physician practices. And there's a number of reasons for that. There's different type of payment policies. There's other incentive structures that have created this situation. But basically, over the past decade, the number of physician practices, so the average doctor out there in private practice, the number of practices that have been acquired by hospitals has more than doubled. And so that was going on before the COVID-19 pandemic. Obviously, there was tremendous disruptions during the pandemic to the finances and the ability of independent practices to care for patients. And so we think it's gone up substantially. So more than a third of physician practices across the United States are associated with a hospital now.
Say that one more time. More than a third?
More than a third. Yeah, wow. More than a third in terms of our best estimates. And this is not something that there are huge comprehensive databases, actually. You know, researchers have to be very careful in terms of how we put together understanding on a broad nationwide way the proportion of physicians that are now either employed by or their practices have been purchased by practices. So it's a big phenomenon. And we have to think about, I think, how it's going to change the delivery of care. And so people might think, okay, what's the big deal? You know, why does it matter if my doctor is associated or the practice is owned by a hospital? And there are a number of ways in which this can be a good thing, potentially, and there's a number of ways in which it can be a less good thing. And so I think that's what we were trying to point out in this commentary and going over the research here is that this is a dominant trend in healthcare, and we actually don't know a ton about how it changes care, how it changes quality, how it changes prices, and we can talk a little bit about those things, but we really want to draw attention to this phenomenon.
And part of the cause and effect are related, as you pointed out, which is, you know, one of the questions you asked was, well, what's driving this? One is potentially the way that we compensate physicians and practices and hospitals based on services. And that also could be relevant to the effect, because if we're reimbursing hospitals more for certain of the same services that a physician practice would do, and then if that physician practice then can reimburse at the same rate now when they become affiliated with a hospital, then it stands to reason that the system is paying more for the same service if more of these practices are being consolidated into the hospital.
That's exactly right. So there are a couple things that are going on here. One is if you have a big behemoth system that has a bunch of physician practices and a bunch of hospitals in an area, they have a lot of leverage, as you can imagine, vis-a-vis insurers. And so they're able to get higher prices for the same services that they're delivering. So that's one way in which costs tend to increase. The other way is that payers like Medicare and other payers will often pay for the same service. They'll pay a higher rate if it's in a hospital setting. And that hospital setting doesn't actually mean you have to be in the hospital. It can be a hospital outpatient department, which is functionally just a clinic that is associated with a hospital. And so you can imagine if you're going to get 30, 40, 50% higher rates just for doing the same thing in a outpatient practice that's associated with a hospital as opposed to an independent one, well, that creates an incentive. And then the last thing I'll point is there's a lot of new administrative burdens that have been placed on physicians and on practices. We need to collect data. We need to report data. You need to purchase certain types of electronic health records, maybe. And all these things have also created a situation in which a lot of physician practices may want to actually merge with a larger entity and get out of the business of medicine and focus on just practicing medicine.
Yeah. And so you've seen this big trend. There's associated data now. There was this piece in, I think it was Health Affairs recently that just came out. I think it might have been just this week. And I'll quote from this piece. It says, we estimate the local market share of each private equity firm. So now we're talking about private equity within 10 physician specialties at the metropolitan service level, statistical area. So they look at different metropolitan areas. They said PE acquired physician practice sites increased from 816 across 119 metropolitan areas in 2012. So that's 816 in 119 metropolitan areas to 5,779 across 307 metropolitan areas in 2021. They said single private equity firms had significant market share exceeding 30% in 108 metropolitan areas and exceeded 50% in 50 of those markets. 50%.
That's staggering.
Yeah.
It's basically a private equity firm will own more than half of the doctors in a particular specialty. And so you can imagine that has tremendous distortions on the market. And it also creates a situation in which prices tend to go up. If you don't have an option but to go to this set of doctors that are owned by private equity firms, they do see pretty clear increases in prices. So it's not just hospital acquisitions, as we talked about. It's also private equity acquisitions. And increasingly, health insurers are buying or physician practices as well. And so you see these kind of integrated systems. You know, I want to be open-minded about whether or not this could have positive effects. So I think, you know, there's often a knee-jerk reaction, you know, in some corners that if private equity is involved with something, you know, we think bad things are going to happen and patients are going to suffer. And so I think we're still learning about what the ultimate impact of private equity firms that are buying hospitals or buying physician practices, what that'll mean. We pretty clearly know and think that probably costs and prices will go up, but does quality go up? Do outcomes get better? The jury is still a little bit out on that. I will say there was a big paper that came out in JAMA a few months ago that looked at private equity firms that are buying hospitals. And what they found was that all sorts of preventable adverse events increase after a private equity firm buys the hospital. So things like surgical site infections, where you get an infection after you have a surgery, things like bloodstream infections that, you know, you have a catheter in your blood and you get an infection, a bacterial infection usually in that case. And people tend to fall more in the hospitals, and that could be due to, you know, less staffing of nursing or nursing aides and so on. So so there's at least some evidence in the hospital space that is concerning, I think. I think, you know, it's one paper. We need more information to kind of get a comprehensive picture. But it's definitely not a good opening salvo in terms of thinking about, does quality go up or down after a private equity firm buys a hospital?
And we'll link to that in the show notes. I've seen similar data in the nursing home front, that when private equity has been involved in nursing homes. I mean, it's interesting to think of this as an area that private equity is concerned with, because the stereotype of private equity is that they look for these businesses that have underlying assets that they can sell and costs that they can cut en route to short-term gain. Whereas a hospital, I understand. Like, if you buy some hospital, that's real estate, right? So that's in and of itself interesting. The cutting cost thing is a little scary, because I don't think most people go into their hospitals and think, wow, this place is overstaffed. You know, I don't know the last time I've had that experience. Most people have experiences waiting in line and frustrations, and they don't have a lot of time with their physicians. So if that becomes even worse, I could imagine this getting a bit scary. I could imagine that a different model of private equity, which I imagine the simplified story on private equity is not totally accurate. I do imagine like steady rates of return is interesting to private equity, and they would hold on to these entities for a long time and say, this is a guarantee of pretty significant like recession-proof margins. And that would be interesting to them.
Yeah. You know, you can envision that some of these places would really benefit from an infusion of capital, whether it's like a rural hospital or it's a nursing home. You could envision that there are certain institutions that are not very efficiently run, and maybe there are efficiencies that can be gained, or if you roll up a bunch of practices or nursing homes, there are economies of scale that result from that. And so, you know, there are ways in which things could go well. I guess my concern is, as you're saying, one of the easiest ways to cut costs is to cut labor. Labor is one of the dominant ways in which healthcare institutions spend their resources. And that's particularly challenging in nursing homes. I mean, nursing home residents are some of the most vulnerable people in this country. They have difficulty advocating for themselves. Some of them may have dementia. They're in a very vulnerable position. And so that gives me a lot of pause when you think about, a firm coming in, trying to figure out a way to cut costs. The most straightforward way to cut costs is to reduce staffing ratios. And what does that do to the quality of care, particularly for people who can't advocate for themselves?
Yeah. Well, okay, let's talk about general trends in healthcare costs. There was this sort of head-turning article in The Economist in the fall that was kind of reacting to some new data and essentially is saying that actually, in contrast to the common perception, healthcare costs in the United States have not been going up, at least as a share of GDP. And they're talking about this healthcare costs as a share of GDP around the world are actually dropping and have been dropping for some time now. I'm curious to see what you think of this data, because the measure is interesting. So healthcare costs as a share of GDP is a very interesting way of looking at it, and probably controversial way of looking at it. Like, are healthcare costs, because it seems to me like it's just an article of faith that healthcare costs have been going up, and certainly has been something I see in my own life. What's going on here?
So it's a totally fascinating body of research that is emerging. And as you say, basically for the past 50 years, healthcare costs have been going up and to the right in every country, every developed country, and particularly in the United States. And so to give you some context, let's say in the 1980s, healthcare was 9% of GDP. And by the 1990s, maybe that's up to 12%. And then you look at, around the time that Obamacare was passed, let's say 2009, 2010, it's about 17% of GDP. And so now we're talking about nearly one in every $5 of the U.S. economy. And that's basically stayed steady for the past 10 years, 12 years, which is kind of a crazy phenomenon if you think about how sharply healthcare costs were going up in the United States for how many decades. So by some estimates, there's an estimate in the New York Times that showed that basically if healthcare costs had continued to increase at the rate that they were between the 80s, 90s, and 2010s, we would basically have spent $4 trillion more than we did over the past decade, which is just an enormous, kind of unfathomable sum of money. So there is something real that's going on here, and it's not entirely clear what is causing this. I think a lot of people have different hypotheses that we can talk about, but the phenomenon that we are not increasing healthcare costs in the way that we were for basically all of the past 30 or 40 years, that much seems to be true both in the United States and in other developed countries.
Yeah, so this Economist article kind of breaks it down to the supply side and demand side potential causes. And on the supply side, they point to increased productivity, like the potential for increased productivity, which is, as they point out, was something that a lot of people felt like what was harder to achieve in healthcare because of personnel dependent is, as you described previously. And so they say that possibly actually, the average radiologist or the average, nurse practitioner is getting more out of the system. And maybe even the existence of more nurse practitioners and more of the healthcare burden on them is part of this. And then they talk about technological change, which obviously undoubtedly could play a difference here. And technological change and innovation and productivity are related. Do you buy any of those two trends as a possibility here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's helpful in the U.S. to break it out into things that could be going on in the U.S. and things that could be going on more broadly. And, initially when I saw some of the data and, for instance, Medicare spending has kind of flattened as compared to its rate of rise in the past. So I thought, okay, it must be basically things that we're doing in the United States that have changed the game a little bit. But then you see the same kinds of things going on in France or the United Kingdom or Germany and so on. And so then you have to broaden your lens a little bit. And so the way that I think about it is that there probably are some things that we did in the United States that have started to bend the cost curve, so to speak. And so you see a lot of the changes coming after the Affordable Care Act was passed. And the Affordable Care Act did a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it straightforwardly cut payment rates to certain hospitals and certain health insurers. And so that in of itself has generated some level of saving, as you can imagine. But it also did some other things like alternative payment models. And so instead of being paid for the volume of services that a healthcare provider offers, they are paid in theory for the value of those services. And look, not all doctors are in these arrangements, and not all the arrangements are, frankly, that effective. But what it has done, I think, is put the idea of cost consciousness on the minds of the healthcare sector in the way that it wasn't before. And so even if you're not directly in one of these payment models, maybe you're thinking about healthcare value, healthcare spending in a way that you weren't before. Another thing that it did was inspire basically a tremendous investment in electronic health records and other forms of health IT. That has created some level of administrative burden. You know, you probably hear about a lot of doctors and other clinicians complaining about the EHR, but it's possible that things like, you know, electronic prescribing, more direct communication between inpatient and outpatient settings, all these things that you said have made the sector a little bit more productive and able to do things in a way that they weren't before. And so I mean, those are kind of US-centric things that I think might be contributing to this trend that we're seeing.
Yeah, it's also interesting. I mean, the fact that it's international is so fascinating, right? Because one thing that it's just going to be hard to ever measure is like whether just changing knowledge and perceptions and culture around health generally, where do you assign that, right? Like the fact that people are so obsessed with the conversation around, you know, like even like superficial things like weight loss, like the way people treat those conversations has never been more obsessive than it was before. I mean, the data is not going in the right direction there, it seems. And how much is like a niche, like elite phenomenon, right? Like the Huberman crowd, right? Like how much of an impact does that kind of conversation even have when you talk about the fact that so much of the healthcare costs are driven by a lower information, lower resource group of people, typically? It would be interesting to see like over time. I'm sure it will be hard to even answer that question for some time.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of the things that are more global, potentially, though we talked about some of the US-centric factors that might be contributing, but there are things that kind of span a lot of countries. So I think about things like new medical breakthroughs. And so in the past, you know, we've had really substantial medical breakthroughs. I mean, even something like a statin or diabetes medicines or blood pressure medicines, things that are now available in a lot of countries and really do seem to reduce the incidence of certain conditions like heart attacks and strokes. And so you can imagine some of the decline that you're seeing across countries is, look, we didn't have widespread statins, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, and now we do. And we're seeing the impact of this really excellent medication that is helping people. The flip side of that is that we haven't had things like new dialysis or organ transplants or stents, like all those things were developed, you know, in the time period that we're talking about and expanded. And so maybe that was what was ballooning, you know, all these new technologies were ballooning healthcare costs in the way that they're not today. That could be a bad thing too. You know, maybe we're not having as many of those kind of breakthrough achievements. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the GLP-1s, right? I mean, these are incredibly effective medications like Ozempic. And if, you know, millions or potentially billions of people are on them, do we actually see the healthcare costs rising again in the way that they wouldn't? And the last thing I'll mention is, you know, this kind of followed the 2008 financial crisis too. And so we don't exactly know the link there, but it's possible that many countries experienced this deep decline in their budgets and healthcare spending just didn't take off again in the way that it had been taking off before. And so there's kind of a secular trend that's related to the financial crisis.
All right, well, let's wade into more controversial territory here. You wrote a piece in The New Yorker recently about what Biden's age means from a medical perspective. And We don't have to talk too much about this, but I just think it would probably be helpful to ground ourselves, and Biden and Trump, what does it mean to be somebody in your 80s doing a job like president? And you wrote about the different types of intelligence and cognitive processes that either are or are not affected by age. And so maybe just, you know, we don't have to spend a ton of time on this, but just what do we know about things like fluid intelligence, crystallized intelligence, memory, processing, and how those things either do or do not decline with age?
Yeah. So this is, not speaking necessarily specifically about Biden or Trump, but the idea is that our minds do change over the course of our lives in general. And, some researchers have proposed this kind of framework that's around called fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. So fluid intelligence is things like thinking creatively, reasoning abstractly, learning new skills. All those things are generally better when we're young, and they kind of peak at a depressingly early age, in some cases in our 20s and 30s. And so we're kind of already on the wrong side of that. But there are things called crystallized intelligence as well, where you're able to integrate knowledge, you're able to learn from past experiences, you're kind of able to apply wisdom to make decisions in really important ways. And that actually tends to increase over time, at least into middle age, into late middle age. And so it's not kind of all downhill in that way. And so I guess the point there is that there is this complex way in which our psychology evolves over the course of our lives. It's not that one is necessarily better than the other, but maybe we want to play to our strengths at different stages of our life. You know, Arthur Brooks has done a lot of writing on this, where he advocates that people actually should change the types of careers or the types of things that they're doing within their careers over the course of their lives in order to better kind of make use of where your mind and your psychology is at that point.
And what do we know about memory over time?
Yeah. So memory, similarly, you know, in terms of your working memory, you know, how many things you can hold in your mind, how effectively you can manipulate it, that's better earlier in life. And that's just, you're quicker, you're sharper, you're able to do kind of those types of tasks in a more effective way. That doesn't mean, you know, it falls off a cliff, as you get older. It doesn't mean that people who have still high stores of working memory and can integrate that with crystallized knowledge can't make excellent decisions. But if you look in that narrow way that, you know, what happens to working memory, it tends to be best earlier in life.
And so like this sort of the subtext, if not like explicit thrust of this, is if you're Biden or Trump or whoever, you want to, instead of sort of taking age as this sort of all-encompassing phenomenon, you want to point to the parts of age that could potentially get better. Now, you know, there's a whole world of, well, okay, if your wisdom, your crystallized intelligence can still get better deep into middle age and beyond, still a question of like, okay, if you're in your 80s, does that at some point top off too? But he would, you know, basically what you're saying is like play, like lean into that and say, I have more of that. I'm not necessarily going to be like super sharp on my feet, but I have all this experience.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, you know, so I think the main thing that I was trying to get across, even, you know, as a doctor who hasn't evaluated any of these people, is that there's actually not going to be a test or a set of tests that decide whether, you know, President Biden or President Trump is fit, quote unquote, fit for office. That is a political determination that voters are going to make. And, you know, my view is that the best way for either one of those candidates to settle debates about their age, whether they are sharp enough, whether they're able to carry out the duties of the office, is to be out there making that case. And so it's not going to be a letter that's put out by the White House physician. It's going to be President Biden out there campaigning. And you saw this at the State of the Union, I think. You know, whether you agree or disagree with the policies and the rhetoric that he espoused in that speech, what you can't say is that he wasn't effective and loud and excited and out there kind of making his case. And I think that reassured a lot of people, at least on the left, who were thinking about, you know, is he going to be able to be an effective campaigner? But even on the right, you saw not kind of Sleepy Joe commentary, you saw, you know, Jacked Up Joe commentary. Yeah. And that's probably enough for him to allay serious concerns about his energy levels and his mental acuity.
Yeah, I was saying this the other day, because I've been somebody who's been critical of his decision to run again, and I had to give him credit for that. And the you know, he benefits from such low expectations. I was making the analogy to George W. Bush. Like, I think, you know, there had been such a pummeling of George W. Bush over his intelligence that when he showed up on the debate stage and was speaking complete sentences, it really worked for him. And I think in this case, Biden, I do think it was a good performance. And when everybody's expecting you to be like a drooling, mumbling, you know, corpse, then it's especially good if your performance is good, you know?
Yeah. I think the same was true of the State of the Union in years past as well. I mean, he seems to like that setting for whatever reason. And one of the questions in my mind is, you know, why do we only see that intermittently? You know, you saw the press conference after Robert Herr's report was put out.
And yeah, it was a mess.
It wasn't sharp. It wasn't, you know, as reassuring as you would like. Whereas the State of the Union, you know, he still has a stutter that he struggles with. He still sometimes slips up on words, but certainly it was a sharp and bold and effective performance.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. You know, the one thing he's got going for him is our politics are so screwed up that there's like so few collective moments anymore. So, you know, outside of the debates, which may not even happen, there's just not many moments when the whole world is watching, right? So it'll be interesting to see how this perception evolves throughout the course of this campaign.
Yeah. And one of the questions is, you know, can that same Joe Biden show up, you know, for the next 7 or 8 months in the same way? Or can you maintain that level of energy and stamina and performance or not?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Again, remind us where can we find your work?
Yeah. So I'm a writer at The New Yorker. That's probably the best place. I'm also a researcher at Weill Cornell, do a lot of health policy research. And finally, I'm a physician, so I care for patients at Cornell as well.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And audience, remember to rate, review, subscribe. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. And we'll be right back next week. Thank you very much, everybody.